Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 8, Text 41. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Atha Vishvesa Vishvatmam Vishvamurti Svakeshume Sneha Pasham Imam Chindi Vidham Pandusu Vishnisu. So Queen Kunti continuing her prayers. O Lord of the universe, soul of the universe, O personality of the form of the universe, please, therefore, sever my ties of affection for my kinsmen, the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. Purport. A pure devotee of the Lord is ashamed to ask anything in self-interest from the Lord. But the householders are sometimes obliged to ask favors from the Lord, being bound by the tie of family affection. Srimati Kunti Devi was conscious of this fact, and therefore she prayed to the Lord to cut off the affectionate tie from her own kinsmen, the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. The Pandavas are her own sons, and the Vrishnis are members of her paternal family. Krishna is equally related to both families. Both the families required the Lord's help because both were dependent devotees of the Lord. Srimati Kunti Devi wished Sri Krishna to remain with her sons, the Pandavas. But by his doing so, her paternal house would be bereft of the benefit. All these partialities troubled the mind of Kunti, and therefore she desired to cut off the affectionate tie. A pure devotee cuts off the limited ties of affection for his family and and widens his activities of devotional service for all forgotten souls. A typical example is the band of the six Goswamis who followed the path of Lord Chaitanya. All of them belong to the most enlightened and cultured, rich families of the higher castes, but for the benefit of the mass of the population, they felt their comfortable home. They left their comfortable homes and became mendicants. To cut off all family affection means to broaden the field of activities. Without doing this, no one can be qualified as a Brahmin, a king, a public leader, a devotee of the Lord. The personality of Godhead as an ideal king showed this by example. Sri Ramachandra cut off the tie of affection for his beloved wife to manifest the qualities of an ideal king. Such personalities as a Brahmin, a devotee, a king, or a public leader must be very broad-minded in discharging their respective duties. Srimati Kunti Devi was conscious of this fact, and being weak, she prayed to be free from the bondage of family affection. The Lord is addressed as the Lord of the universe or the Lord of the universal mind, indicating his all-powerful ability to cut the hard knot of family affection. Therefore, it is sometimes experienced that the Lord, out of his special affinity towards a weak devotee, breaks the family affection by force of circumstances arranged by his powerful energy. By doing so, he causes the devotee to be completely dependent on him and thus clears the path for his going back to Godhead. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Taksur Mutam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Krishnam Tapitam Yena Bhutale Ayam Rupa Kadamayam Vidati Prapadantikam Adadanas Janandante Idam Yache Puna Puna Srimadu Prapadam Boja Vilisham Janma Janmini. Parāgya-yuk-bhakti-viśaṁ-te-yatnāya-bhāya-māma-na-bhipṣa-nandam Kripaṁ-bhidhiyā-paradūka-devī Sanātana-stham-prabhu-māstrayāmi Vanchā-kalpā-tarūk-yashtā Tata-sintu-paye-vishā Patitānam-pāvanevyo Vaiṣṇavevyo Namo-namā Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Ghor Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So greetings from Govardhan. The Kartik month, I guess, is heating up here as it gets closer to Govardhan Puja and Prabhupada's disappearance day. More and more pilgrims, actually, and more devotees come. And at least for the last few days, I found myself early in the morning taking people around Govardhan or Radhika rather than kind of my regular schedule. But it's very, very nice leaving at 7 o'clock and the other day just walked towards Radhika, Govinda, just chanting it was so nice. I just went to Govindakund. I didn't have that much time, but actually I wound up coming back about 11 or 12. But just kind of chanting in the Dham and seeing what doors to the spiritual world opened by the mercy of Giriraj. Just around Govindakund, I never went to so many small little ashrams that it practically the life is as if the six Goswamis. Never saw this before, just walking past Govindakund, small little Jagannath temple. I don't know if many people saw that. It's such a sweet devotee who is worshipping those deities for so many years, living like the Goswamis, very, very peaceful and quiet. And it was nice. He showed me different pictures on the altar they had there. And those who come to my Wednesday class, where Bhakti Sandarbha were talking about deity worship, and some discussion came up about in deity worship, meditating on the English they translated sanctum sanctorium, and Sanskrit the yoga pit, place of meeting. We have in Vrindavan in the morning, at Vrindakund in midday at Radhakund in the evening, the Radha Govinda, and there's all these descriptions of the Lord sitting on a throne surrounded by his associates in different concentric layers. And it's a bona fide meditation. So we were just talking about it, and he showed us the pictures. First one of the Radhakund meditation, which is very nice. And then the Navadvip meditation, and he was showing it, and those concentric circles of devotees, and they're written in Bengali. And it was nice. Then there were like these four devotees at these four doors. And he'd say, those are the protectors of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's kirtan. And, on one side it was Shivananda Sen and Mukunda. And then I said, what's this? Oh, that's where Rupa Goswami. So it's a meditation of all the lords or something. It's such a sweet devotee, and then we walked, and there was another little ashram. I think they had 24-hour kirtan. And there was a very nice sadhu who was chanting, and, every once in a while, he was really into it. It was a very, very good kirtan. I was with the Kinchin of Krishna, who's quite a very nice musician, and he was just in ecstasy. back when I had to go back, he still stayed just to see the kirtan. And just such a beautifully done, simple. And the sadhu would just smile in the kirtan. And it gave me a realization. It was a very beautiful smile. It came from the heart. It came from the devotion. And I kind of understand, and I've actually heard this, that that's real beauty. When they say that Krishna is beautiful, it's not just referring to a physical form. It's referring to his heart and his love, which manifests the beauty in the physical form. In other words, you may have a Bollywood, Hollywood starlight or whatever it is, but if their beauty was a product of lust and how to enjoy the world, that's one type of beauty. But a beauty is out of love and how to please the senses of Krishna. First of all, because it's the beauty of the natural, the nature of the soul, it's a happiness. The beauty that's produced from lust is not a happiness. And we all know that happiness makes one beautiful. That's why when you take a picture, you smile. And when you're happy, even you feign happiness. But when someone's really happy and they're beautiful and they're pure in heart, that's real beauty, and that's the spiritual world. And Krishna is beautiful like that. There's a connection, and his devotees are beautiful like that. Because their beauty is a manifestation of prema. Radharani herself is Mahabhav Surubini. She's the embodiment of the highest consciousness and sense that Krishna should be pleased. And that sense has a form which represents her desire to be beautiful for the pleasure of Krishna. Anyway, it was so nice, the sadhu chanting those melodies. And then I was taking these two devotees around and with the Kinshana, and they were two nice brahmacharis from London, Soho Street. But very, very nice culture, very nice people. And sure enough, at the end of the prikram, I went to Govindakund and I said, okay, let's just pay a dandavat parikram, a dandavat to go on hill. And then we meditated in the sand, and when I got up, that poor brahmachari said, oh, where's my bag? Where's my bag? Well, she didn't have much money in it because he's a brahmachari, but then some teenager, I guess, just grabbed the bag and ran up Govardhan Hill. What do? You can't chase him there. But anyway, what that's about. But now let's discuss these prayers of Kunti and somehow or other try to meditate on her. This is actually how one develops Krishna consciousness. I was reading a very interesting description of Raghunuga Bhakti that's very, very practical, believe it or not, in the Bhakti Sandarbha. I wanted to share it with you. And it relates to hearing these pastimes like by Queen Kunti. And what it describes is this is really how the process works. You don't know your eternal relationship with Krishna. You haven't come to that point. But you develop taste by associating with those devotees who do, either personally or in the form of books. In the form of books, which are the expressions of that love by devotees. And in a simple way, I explain it like this. You don't have, your eternal relationship with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or some kind of Brahmin boy in Navadvip, Seva Sadaka Rupena, Siddha Rupena Chakri. We have a Sadaka Rupa. A Sadaka Rupa means a perfected form of Gaudiya. And generally, it's of some kind of Brahmin boy in relationship to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that serves Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we don't know that. But just because we don't know that, it doesn't mean we can't have taste to serving Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So when you read in Bhavan Das Thakur's Chaitanya Bhagavat and you hear the love, the pure love of the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, So what you do is when you hear that, you get a taste for that. Then it describes that if you're practicing Krishna consciousness and purifying your heart becomes like a crystal and it will reflect that. And this is actually at the level of Vaidhi Bhakti, how we're practicing Vaidhi Bhakti, but cultivating Rab, cultivating that spirit. That's why our Vaidhi Bhakti, it doesn't go to Vaikuntha. So we're listening. We hear. We know there's devotees that have taste for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And if we hear from them and we're practicing and purifying our hearts and we read Chaitanya Bhagavat, etc. like that, their devotion will be reflected in our hearts. In the same way, if we listen to the prayers of Queen Kunti, then and practice the practice and adopt the practices of Krishna consciousness and listen and develop a taste, then those qualities will be reflected in our heart. Actually, it's a fact that it's described that a powerful sadhu, he will be affected by his presence without an awareness of who he is. It's like prophets are like medicine. So it's nice, therefore, to meditate on these prayers of Queen Kunti and try to have her sense of dependence, come into our heart. So we read her prayers, and she is worshiping the Supreme Lord, who is known to the dependent devotee. And when one is dependent on God, I think it was mentioned also here in this purport, the same thing if I could find it. Both the families required the Lord's help because both were dependent devotees of the Lord. So you develop that dependence, that shelter. And again, it's not just a selfish mood. It's the innermost need of the heart to love. And to love. So it's an expression of love. When you develop that, then Krishna reciprocates. And one of his reciprocations with the devotee is to make himself known. He's known to the devotee who wants Krishna and wants that relationship with Krishna and wants to depend on Krishna. Then Krishna becomes known. And this is the essence of Queen Kunti's prayers. And although he becomes known to his devotee, which means in a localized form, it does not limit his all-pervasive nature. It does not limit his position as God. Just like Mother Yasoda looked into baby Krishna's mouth because she had eaten some mud, and she looked into his mouth, and what did she saw? She succeeded. She saw everything, the whole universe, including herself and Krishna. Within Krishna's mouth was everything, including that which was outside of Krishna. And therefore, when she tried to bind Krishna, it was always 2 inches too short. It's a form, but it's an unlimited form. So she's praying, you are God, you're appearing before us. We are completely dependent on you. And this is the mood of Kunti. So dependent on Krishna that if she had a choice between a peaceful life materially without Krishna and a calamitous life with Krishna, she would choose Krishna. That's called ahoitaki apratiyata, yayatma supasidati. That's pure devotional service. That's pure devotional service. That there's nothing more painful than not Krishna. And there's nothing more pleasurable than Krishna. Someone, I guess they call them senior moments. Now some had a phone moment there. So number 6, mute your phone. Somehow. But then I hear breathing and things, and I'm trying to. Her mood, I want Krishna. Krishna is so good that there's no greater pain than being without Krishna. And this is not just eulogy or exaggeration. This is actually the nature of self-realization. There's no pain greater than being without Krishna, for one who actually has love with Krishna. Love for Krishna. And therefore, with the example of Prahlad Maharaj, where his father said, give up Krishna, I'll throw you into a pit of venomous snakes. And he thought, the pain of being without Krishna is more painful than that. I don't know, I can't say that. I can't say that. You know? That's how he felt. That's how much he loved Krishna. Without Krishna, there's no life. So these are the mood. And therefore, you cannot break a pure devotee's devotional service because you cannot give something better than that to allure the person from that service. And you can't cause pain to that person greater than giving up that devotional service, giving up Krishna. So this is the mood of the devotees in their heart. Krishna, 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 Pari, Ma. Krishna is everything to them. So now Kunti, after expressing those prayers and glorifying Krishna, now she'll directly express this. I'm trying to get in a mood to, like, you know, kind of move this along. And I'll just read those. Oh, my Lord, you have executed all your duties yourself. Are you leaving us today? Though we are completely dependent on your mercy and have no one else to protect us when all the kings are in enmity with us. So this is her mood. Are you leaving? Because we are completely dependent, and Prabhupada makes that point that this dependence is the greatest fortune. Because it's the nature of the soul. It's the glory of the soul. The glory of something is its nature. Glory of sugar is its sweetness. The glory of water is its wetness. The glory of the soul is its dependence on God. And that's the glory of the soul. It's also the happiness of the soul. So she's having this feeling. Dependent. She's completely dependent. And therefore, if the sense, and Prabhupada discusses this in the purport, that type of dependence, which is the constitutional nature of the living entity, it's not a forced servitude. It's the nature of the soul. Like a fish is dependent on water because it is an aquatic. And we are dependent on Krishna because we are his servant. And we're part of him, and we're meant for his service. And therefore, when we are not in that relationship with Krishna, then the separation, the Prabhupada said, is like a thunderbolt. It's the greatest pain. And therefore, it's a very nice term, which explains it. Because again, from the Western mind, you know, when you, I don't know, you translate these words like surrender and dependence, they have so many negative connotations that it's almost hard to use the terms and have the people understand them properly. So I'm trying to explain it. It's dependence in terms of a constitution. Not just like when you force, like, you know, we have dependence as something that's unnatural. You know, that our natural thing is to have initiative, and then, you know, we're too dependent, a sign of weakness. But it's not that type of dependence. It's a type of dependence of constitution and nature. A very nice example, just like here in Govardhan, right next to the sweet shop is a big old building. I don't think it's still what it is, but it was an orphanage. And an orphanage is called Anatha Laya. Laya means place. Anatha means controller or master. An orphan is Anatha, one who doesn't have a master, one who doesn't have a controller. So being without Krishna is the independence of an orphan. He has no shelter. He has no protection. That type of independence. No one glorifies an orphan. Oh, an orphan is great. He doesn't have a mother and father. He's free. He's independent. Wow, he's great. He's strong. And that's a very good position. You're so fortunate. No. The child is fortunate who has the controller, he has the shelter, he has the parents. So in that way, our relationship with Krishna is like that. There's a constitutional need. That's what the child has, a constitutional need for his parents. We have a constitutional need for Krishna. And as Prabhupada said, he makes very clear that type of dependence, it's not the parasite. It's not taking away valor. It's not taking away initiative. It's just talking about the constitution. And once you have that, you have initiative, you have freedom. It's just like in the state. The criminal is independent. He gets incarcerated. The citizen who follows the law is free. He has the valor. So it's not that where it robs the initiative, the independence, the individuality, etc. It's talking about our core constitution, who we are. And from that platform comes life. The fish in the water has life. The child who is with parents has life, has nourishment. The citizen who's abiding by the laws is free. And the devotee who takes full shelter of Krishna has full, that's freedom, the regulative principles of freedom, Prabhupada calls it. He's free in that sense. So this is the mood that she's expressing, and her heart comes out. It's like the pain of the body. Without the senses, without the body, it's finished. So without Krishna, we're useless. He says, without Krishna, hair on your shoes, first day. Oh, I'm dead lost. Excuse me. So here it explains. It says, Kunti is quite aware that the existence of the Pandavas is due to Sri Krishna only. The Pandavas are undoubtedly well established in name and fame and guided by the great King Yudhisthira, whose morality personified, and the Yadus are undoubtedly great allies. Without the guidance of Krishna, all of them are non-entities, as much as the senses of the body are useless without the guidance of consciousness. So this type of dependence is talking about our constitution, where we belong to get strength. So the living beings are always dependent, and the ultimate dependable object is the Lord himself. And then he describes that without Krishna, without the lotus feet of Krishna, the world loses its charm. So without Krishna, there is no beauty. And conversely, without Krishna, there is no austerity, because all natural gifts depend on the mercy of the Lord. So she's going on, and now we got up to today's verse, which we can go in a very beautiful verse, which he's saying, to sever my ties of affection for my kinsmen. The pure devotee, all the attention is diverted towards the service of Krishna. That's everything else is secondary to that, and it doesn't mean to neglect other things. It's talking about a priority, and everything is meant for that objective. And everything else we do in the temporal world, including satisfy our needs and desires for things and relationships, are done in relationship to that, ultimately, for a person who actually has spiritual knowledge and understands that the goal of life, the goal, Krishna Kumarta Mahan, that the goal of life is to fill our heart up with love for God, which is inclusive of everything else. So we see Queen Kunti, she is so chaste and dedicated to Krishna that, you see, when someone is pure, they magnify faults. And when someone is impure, they tend to minimize them. Just like Raghunath Das Goswami, he was taking just a few drops of buttermilk and feeling, oh, I'm such a debauchee. You know, I'm such a lustful person. Or if you have a glass of water that's completely clean, even a few drops of dirt will become apparent. So at this level of emotion that she's feeling, and the love and dependence that she's feeling for Krishna as her life, then anything that appears even to be self-interest, she's ashamed of. So she has this dilemma here. And the dilemma is that she has attachment both to her immediate family and a paternal family. And both are devotees of Krishna. So here she is praying, stay with us, stay with us, stay with us, stay with us. And then she starts thinking about the Vishnus. Well, now we have life, but now my maternal family doesn't have life. So these considerations are going back and forth, and then she kind of condemns herself. or having any interest separate from Krishna. And Prabhupada discusses that you know, obviously the greatest person has concern for everyone as much as possible. Humanity, you know, in history, the greatest people are those who serve the greatest good. And for that greatest good, people can, who are qualified, make individual sacrifices, like these six Goswamis. They gave up even the kingdom and the government, and they were the head of the government for the service of all living entities. There's that verse by the six Goswamis. Tatvatuna mashesha mandalapati trainim sadatu chava putadina ganesha kao karunaya kopina kanta srita putadina ganesha kao karunaya. Out of compassion, putadina, for all the people in the world who is poor, bereft of Krishna consciousness, Bhutvadina, Ganesha, Kalkarunaya, Kopina, Kantashita, they took the day of Tatvaturnam, Ashesha, Mandala, Patishrayim, so they keep up everything else is insignificant. So that sense is there. Prabhupada's elaborating on that. And Kunti is disturbed that the familiar affection will limit her dependence on Krishna as she's making these considerations. But ultimately, and actually Jiva Goswami comments on this verse, it's not there particularly in Prabhupada's purport, but I read it in Bhurijan's book, that actually her real prayer is, oh Krishna, because she's a Vaishnava, and her family are devotees. So her family are devotees. So Prabhupada says like this also, he makes that point in the previous verse. Let me see if I can find that. And her affection for the Pandavas and the Vishnu is not out of the range of devotional service, because the service of the Lord and the service of the devotees are identical. Sometimes service to the devotees is more valuable than service to the Lord. But here the affection of Kunti Devi for the Pandavas and Vishnu was due to family relations. But Jiva Goswami gives another view, that actually her prayer is, as a devotee and compassionate to everyone, her dilemma is she actually, Krishna, can you give your association and be with both the family members? In other words, she had a sentiment for them as devotees also. So this is the devotee. If she's so, her attention is so much focused on Krishna, and she doesn't want it devoted to anything else. And that's not narrow or limited, because Krishna is inclusive of everything. Prabhupada says in the introduction of Nectar Devotion that everyone wants to satisfy love to the greatest limit. What is that point where you can extend love to the greatest limit, where you can be fully satisfied and everyone can be satisfied? That's Krishna. That's Krishna. So, Kaine Nanya Vishaya Matir Madhupate Sukri Vatim Udvahatar Adha Gange Vagham Udandati. O Lord of Madhu, as the Ganges forever flows to the sea without hindrance, let my attraction be constantly drawn unto you without being diverted to anyone else. So this is what she's saying. Let me have that praying that my devotion is flowing to you without designation ultimately to anything that's not Krishna. really all that exists is Krishna and things in relationship to Krishna. The illusion of material relations is to see something as separate from Krishna, and therefore ultimately made for your own enjoyment. And if we look at it, I mean, from a purely Gyanic view, the body is temporary and therefore it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist as the person, because that which is changing has no existence. What exists is Krishna's energy. And that energy may transform, but the conception that transformation of energy in terms of a body is an entity in itself is an illusion. That's an imposition that this is a person from the highest philosophical standpoint. If you look at the body, well, no, the person does not exist as the body. It's just element. What exists are eternal material elements of Krishna. The conception that those material elements are designated in a particular place and are a particular living entity, that's an illusion. What ultimately exists is Krishna and Krishna's energies. That is an illusion, an imposition of the mind. And to sacrifice the service of Krishna for the service of something that's illusory. Of course, there's a higher vision. The higher vision is seeing the person as the soul. And that soul is inhabiting by karma a particular set of material elements. Right? And then, well, especially when that soul comes up to the point of Krishna consciousness and therefore is using that encagement or elements in the service of God, then the service to that person is as good as the service to God. But anyway, here's look at this mood of pure love. As the Ganges flows to the sea without hindrance, let my attention be constantly drawn into you without anything else. That's prema bhakti. There's nothing else in the consciousness but Krishna. Perfection of pure devotional service attained when all attention is directed towards the transcendental loving service of the Lord. And then Prabhupada says, to cut off the tie of all other affections does not mean complete negation of the finer elements, like affection for someone else. So it's very interesting how Prabhupada balances it. To cut off the tie of all other affections does not mean complete negation of the finer elements, like affection for someone else. This is not possible. Living being, whoever he may be, must have this feeling of affection for others, because this is a symptom of life. The symptoms of life, such as desire, anger, hankering, stealing, attraction, cannot be annihilated. Only the objective has to be changed. So, the objective has to be changed. We have to see these things in relationship with Krishna. So, Prabhupada gives a very, very high vision, but it's a vision from the absolute perspective. And according to our realization, we try to live by that vision and apply it within our lives. But here it's very, very practical. So when this desire is changed and directed in service towards Krishna, and then he gave the example, a classic example of Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, and it's interesting how his consciousness changed. When he heard the message of the Lord, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, he changed his decision and served the Lord. This is the purpose of hearing. To hear the message of Krishna is to change the attention of our consciousness. And doing so, he became a famous devotee. The Pali was there, the friendship was there, Arjuna was there, Krishna was there, but Arjuna became a different person by devotional service. Therefore, the prayers of Kunti also indicate the same categorical changes in activity. Kunti wanted to serve the Lord without diversion, and that was her prayer. This unalloyed devotion is the ultimate goal of life. Our attention is usually diverted to the service of something which is not godly or not in the program of the Lord. When the program is changed into the service of the Lord, that is to say when the senses are purified in relation with the service, that is called pure unalloyed devotional service. Srimati Kunti Devi wanted that perfection and prayed for it from the Lord. So this is the nature. And this is praying. And praying is always described as the river flowing to the sea, because there's nothing that can stop it. No one can stop the Ganges. You can build a mountain or something and it will flow around it. It has a force connected with its objective or goal. So when pure love from the heart comes directed towards Krishna, it can't be stopped. Apratiyatai can't be broken. A very interesting point was made about this, and I mentioned it before, is that to stop an activity, you have to find the cause of that activity. For example, a person is working, and their work, the cause of their work is that they want money. So they're working for money. Well, you want him to stop work? Don't pay him anymore. He won't work. So as long as there's as long as there's motive, then that activity will be broken. I was every evening between 5 and 7, I go from my little place here and I go to the Govardhan, Bhaktivedanta Ashram, and we go to one room, Keshav Bharti, Vaisheshika Prabhu, sometimes Jayadvaita Swami, and a few young devotees, and we discuss Shastra. And Vaisheshika Prabhu was describing, he said, just like when people go out and distribute books, if they have a motive for doing it, then it'll only last for some time. Because when the cause of it is stopped, whatever it is, the praise or the fame or whatever it is stopped, then the activity stops. When you do something out of love, there's no external cause. So how do you stop it? I'm doing it out of love. Okay, stop my activity. How will you stop the activity? If I'm actually doing something out of love, how can you stop the activity? There's no cause for it other than love. And you can't stop the love. It's a causeless activity in the sense that it has no cause outside of itself. So how do you stop that activity? So love or devotion, when it's pure, it's uninterrupted like the river flowing down to the sea. And she wants that. I don't want it to be diverted because I have some other desires. So Kunti is praying like this. I'm going to stop here now and see if there are any questions, because these are always sensitive subjects that have a history of application. Sometimes it's very, very difficult to discuss the ideals. You know, there's the ideals of something and it's the practical application. But when the ideals have been misused, when you discuss it, it becomes almost like an emotional issue. And you may be thinking, I'm going to explain the ideals of a particular thing. But when there's been abuse of the ideals, then it's hard to discuss it separate from that. And that sometimes becomes like a problem in discussing philosophy. is you discuss its, you know, ideals. And then it's important to understand the ideals, because if you understand the ideals, then you can have the proper application of those ideals. But when the ideals have already been improperly applied, it becomes very difficult. Or it's easy to misunderstand that, because the way the philosophy has been used. Anyway, would anybody like to ask any questions?
Maharaj?
Yes.
It's Mooney, please accept my humble obeisances.
Thanks
for another really inspiring class. My question is this, Maharaj, and it's not clear to me whether it's a question about the actual rule or about the misapplication, so you can help me understand
that. Good.
Lately, in class, I've been reading Confucius, and we've talked about that. And Confucius was extremely wise.
Would you like to speak more clearly?
Okay, yeah, 1 second. For now or no? I don't know. Is it better?
It's better, yeah.
Okay. So lately I've been reading Confucius, who's really, actually he's really cool. He's really wise. And he talked about duty and the fact that duty has to be filtered through your relationships. And how duty is, and if you apply duty with a misunderstanding of relationships, it creates big problems and you actually neglect your duty. And an example that came up in our discussion of him was that, you know, if the President of the United States cares so much about France that he gives all the money to take care of the homeless in America, to take care of the homeless in France, even if it's motivated by the right ideal, because he's not actually taking care of those in his charge, he's transgressed his duty. So my question, Marge, is you had mentioned earlier how, you know, sometimes great people that go beyond the limited scope of their family duties or their local duties to their town or to whoever, because they want to go for something universal, and this is the right thing to do. And I don't want to challenge that, but it seems to me that...
Please do.
Sorry?
Please do.
Well, I mean, I don't know, because I think there's a way where it's not necessarily contradictory, but I'm not...
I appreciate you bringing out this point. It's very nice. Yeah. Good. Keep on going.
My question, maybe I'll put the question like this. If someone wants to serve Krishna or do the universal service, are their local, are the people in their charge just inevitable consequences or victims of their spiritual progress? Or is it actually transgressing their duty to not take care of them directly?
Well, I would say I would answer in a few ways. I think, first of all, our duties are determined by our attachments. That's a fact. So there is some place, right? There is some place in a social structure that when one actually comes above the platform of attachment, he also is free from duties. And then it becomes a question of what's the example for society, basically. You know, and that is there. And even in the Vedic society, therefore, there is sannyas, and someone does leave his family, you know. So there is some scope for that, right? He has a family to leave it. But it's not his duty anymore because, you know, he's purified himself of the attachments that caused that duty. Of course, you have to be extremely careful about that. And also, I think the second point is, it doesn't mean you give up the duties.